Why decide to write a book titled Contagion Myth?
Through understanding the history of contagion, we understand really how we got to the present day. But then I had an experience that I would say changed my life.
What are your thoughts with COVID and coronavirus? Are you someone that trusts taking a vaccine, or there's no way in the world you're going to touch a vaccine?
All of the tests are meaningless. All of the numbers are meaningless. There is no possible way that COVID-19 is caused by this coronavirus.
How do I get sick? I can't give my germ to somebody else. Is that kind of what you're saying?
No, that is not what I'm saying. What it proves is you can't give sickness to somebody else.
A little bit complicated, but I'm trying to up my intelligence, so keep going.
If you look at a cookbook from 1920, butter, lard, and eggs. Nobody had heart attacks. So we're thinking one person is sick, another person gets sick, there must be something spread. And that observation is what's called epidemiological observation. Now, I just want to point out something here, that this contagion theory was applied to the following disease. There was a bunch of sailors who got sick, and one sailor after another got sick, and their teeth fell out, and then they went into heart failure and died. And this happened into thousands and thousands of people. And it was usually one ship after another. And for 100 years, they said, this must be contagious. And then somebody ate a lime and the whole thing went away because it turns out it was scurvy. And the reason I point that out is epidemiological observations, like this person got sick and then somebody else got sick, is well accepted in medicine. That is not how we prove causation. And you hear this now all the time. Well, a lot of people in one place got sick, so it must be a virus. Well, they blew a bomb off in Hiroshima. A lot of people got sick, and nobody thinks that was a virus. Or they'll say, if it spreads from one place to another, that proves it's a virus. So I'm sure you remember Chernobyl. There was a nuclear accident. A lot of people died. It started spreading into Eastern Europe and then Western Europe. A lot of people got sick. And as far as I can tell, that's no evidence that that was a virus. In other words, the idea that a lot of people in Iran or Turkey or Spain or the nursing home or the cruise ship or the whatever got sick, you know, my Aunt Bessie went to a party, those are epidemiological observations, the purpose of which is to generate theories which can be tested for causation, period. And I would agree 100% that we had enough evidence with contagion that we should investigate for an infectious cause or an unseen agent. Now, that's what Louis Pasteur famously did. He said, there's all these people, and in fact, what he used was the case of sheep, and said, there's all these sheep getting sick. One sheep after another. Sometimes the people who were handling the sheep got sick. So there must be something that's passed. They then had invented the microscope. So the first eureka moment in history then is they could see this bacteria under the microscope. And they saw the bacteria in the sheep, and they saw it in the next sheep who got sick. End of story, that's what caused the sheep to get sick, called anthrax. But here's what happened then. Pasteur isolated the anthrax bacteria from the sheep, right? So he mm-hmm. took them out,
yeah,
and he gave them to other sheep, and none of them got sick. None of the people got sick. Now, here's the way I think people should understand this. Imagine you have a cow, and you don't feed the cow proper food, which is grass, right? You feed it cardboard and dead cow parts and, you know, and you soak it in glyphosate and tick poisons, etc. All that stuff comes out in the milk. Now, then somebody drinks the milk and gets sick. Mm. That's contagion, right? And then you look in the milk and you see a bacteria called Listeria. And you say, okay, that may be the causative agent. And then you look in the stool of the person and they also have Listeria. End of story. And so the Listeria, you drank Listeria, it made you sick. Now, unfortunately though, or maybe fortunately, there's another explanation for that, which is The cow was sick. The milk, the poisons went into the milk. The role of bacteria in nature is to biodegrade poisons, right? If you have a compost pile and you put dead squirrels in it, you'll get bacteria to eat the squirrels. If you have a pond and you put poisons in it, you get algae growth that eat the poisons. If you have a forest and you cut the trees down, the algae and the fungus and the bacteria eat the dead trees. That's called biology. That's called bioremediation. So how do you know that the listeria isn't there to digest the poisons in the milk? So we have two very clear explanations for what may have happened, right? It's either the bacteria or it's the poison, and the bacteria are not causing anything. They're just helping you out by eating the poisons, as they do in nature. Now, what I tell people is this is what Pasteur and his colleagues did for 40 years, because there is a very simple way to sort this out. All you have to do is isolate the listeria from the milk, right? You can't give them all the milk because then you don't know if the poison's in it. Isolate the listeria, give that to a bunch of animals, see what happens. That's what they did for 40 years. And as far as I can tell from the medical literature, no animal or person gets sick.
The Jew can grow money on trees, so that's not an issue. The Jew has all the money in the world, controls all the money in the world. Everything the way it works, the stock markets and commodities and currencies and banking of every type, all the insurance companies internationally, the Jew owns and controls all of that. The Jew designed it all. You are living and functioning under a Jew system, the central banks, and that's how the Jew controls every single nation, every country. Immiserate their entire populations because of this new scheme that's going on, COVID, with Israel setting the example. What do you know? And of course it's safe and effective, because guess what? Israel designed and is manufacturing the vaccine to save humanity, because they all work for the Jew. All of them. In lockstep.
It's called lockstep. Lockstep. And this is a phrase that I used right after 2001, when I saw the entire system of the United States, including the population, were in lockstep. So the Congress went along, and yes, it was Osama bin Laden, and the people waved their flag and said, I hate, 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 and everything was in lockstep. Well, in 2010, They published this, Rockefeller Foundation, and here's what they're saying. They call it a scenario. These are scenario narratives, and they speak about it in the past tense. So they put out this scenario, lockstep. A world of tighter top-down government control and more authoritarian leadership with limited innovation and growing citizen pushback. Okay, I'll read a little bit of it. In 2012, the pandemic that the world had been anticipating for years, nobody was anticipating a pandemic, finally hit. Unlike 2009's H1N1, this new influenza strain originating from wild geese, they use some scenario, but this is Ebola they're talking about.
Ahead.
Even the most pandemic prepared nations were quickly overwhelmed when the virus streaked around the world, infecting nearly 20% of the global population and killing 8 million in just 7 months, the majority of them healthy young adults. The pandemic also had a deadly effect on economies. You can see the agenda, just naked, raw, naked control agenda written down, and it's anybody's guess how this becomes effectuated in real life. So whether this is written specifically as marching orders or whether people take it upon themselves in the intelligence networks to say, okay, well, this has been produced, so this is the plan here. But these narratives have to be written in advance because the intelligence agencies don't know how to do this, these narratives. They need help. So these think tanks, they come up with these, like Rand Corporation, Rockefeller Foundation. These are think tanks of death. They're not The think tanks, they're not there to find great ways to help people. Right? Okay, the pandemic also had a deadly effect on economics. International mobility of both people and goods screeched to a halt, right? Which is what they want. They want a completely isolated world, right? Debilitating industries like tourism and breaking global supply chains. Well, of course they want tourism stopped because they're not in the tourism business, and they want you at home in your house in front of the TV. Then they got you, because once you watch the TV, they own your soul. Even locally, normally bustling shops and offices sat empty for months. Okay, so I love how they talk about it in the past tense, in 2010. The pandemic blanketed the planet, though disproportionate numbers in Africa died. Southeast Asia and Central America, where the virus spread like wildfire.
It sounds like the opening monologue of a disaster movie, right?
Exactly. Now listen, here's the good stuff now. But even in developed countries, containment was a challenge. Now here's this one. I love this one. The United States' initial policy of strongly discouraging, in quotation marks, strongly discouraging citizens from flying proved deadly in its leniencies. So they should have been tougher, right? Accelerating the spread of the virus, not just within the United States, but across borders. However, a few countries did fare better. China, in particular. The Chinese government's quick imposition and enforcement of mandatory quarantine for all citizens, as well as its instant and near hermetic sealing off of all borders, saved millions of lives, stopping the spread of virus far earlier than in other countries. So the message is here is we have to look towards the Chinese, the oppressive
totalitarian.
Yeah, Chinese regime, as an example of what we need to be doing here. And of course, the ruling class here loves the Chinese regime because they have demonstrated to the ruling class the most efficient form of capitalism, which is authoritarian capitalism. China's government was not the only one that took extreme measures to protect its citizens from risk and exposure. During the pandemic, national leaders around the world flexed their muscles, flexed their authority, and imposed airtight rules and restrictions, from the mandatory wearing of face masks to body temperature checks at the entries to communal spaces. What they're saying is they're building a system where every move you make, you've got to go through them. Even after the pandemic faded, this more authoritarian control and oversight of citizens and their activities stuck and even intensified. In order to protect themselves from the spread of increasingly global problems, from pandemics and national terrorism to environmental crisis and rising poverty, leaders around the world took a firmer grip on power. Well, what the hell would rising poverty have anything to do with imposing strict citizen controls with face masks? So they're very sloppy stuff here. At first, the notion of a more controlled world gained wide acceptance and approval. Citizens willingly gave up some of their sovereignty and their privacy to more paternalistic states in exchange for greater safety and stability. I mean, that's just a complete naked contradiction to the famous saying that if you think you're going to give up a little bit of security, I mean, if you're going to give up your freedom for security, you're going to get neither. That's the long-standing thing. And here what they're doing is they're not even ashamed or embarrassed to absolutely say the exact opposite. They're saying, yes, we all want to give up our privacy and sovereignty for more stability and security and stability. So you don't get that. When you give it up like that, you get the shaft. Two more documents. Keep it zoomed. We have the National Security Memorandum of December 10th, 1974. This is Henry Kissinger's brainchild. The National Security Memorandum number 200. You can look that up on your internet. I'll summarize it. He says that there's too many people. We got to get rid of the population. So to answer your question.
Oh, from earlier.
Yeah. He says he used the word depopulation, which is different. Depopulation means killing people that already exist, and it's to get the minerals because we need the minerals. And here's another one. The CDC has a patent on Ebola. They patented it.
Yeah? Oh,
really? So basically, if you want to get a cure for your Ebola,
It says it right up here, right? It says human Ebola virus species and compositions and methods thereof, and it's a patent.
It's a patent. They patented the main strain plus something like 17 other strains of it. So they own it. They want to get more control, more and it's going to be curfews and quarantines. So what I'm saying is that unless the American people start to get some new way to revolt, a new way to organize, new way to protest, unless we can break through the apathy, because that's what we have here, then it's going to be a slave state here. The ruling class doesn't seem to have too much resistance. They're getting everything on their Christmas shopping list. And they've been wanting quarantines and curfews for a long time. Now they got it. And if you want to live in a world where you're tricked into all this stuff because it's for your safety, right? And if you want to have a probe and make sure you got to check your pockets, make sure you don't have anything incriminating on you before you go out, and when you step out of your house, you want some police there to monitor and see what you're doing. If that's the world you want to live in, be apathetic. Don't do anything. You're going to get that world very soon. It's coming your way, definitely.
Whatever agenda the Jew invents and implements, you have no right to resist it or to not follow it, the Jew agenda, whatever it is, however abusive, authoritarian, however disgracing it is, demeaning it is, blasphemous, depraved, ridiculous, ludicrous, insane. If you don't follow the Jew agenda, regardless of how illogical, if you don't follow it, the Jew agenda, you're an anti-Semite. You're an enemy of the Jews.
Yours is a voice of criticism we don't often hear in the United States. Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money, and the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country. As you know, they have power, which it's okay, they are talented people and they have power, money and media and other things. and their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong, the identification. And they are not ready to hear criticism. And it's very easy to blame people who criticize certain acts of the Israeli government as anti-Semitic and to bring up the Holocaust and the suffering of the Jewish people. And that justifies everything we do to the Palestinians.
And there is Orwell writing this, which was supposed to be in the future, but it was not really the future. It was right then and there. I mean, just remember that the Germans were being genocided as Orwell was writing that book. Right when he finished that book, the Germans, all of Germany was going to be exterminated by the Jew. And the American knew nothing about this. Absolutely nothing. How can I have respect for these people? I ask you, how can I? It's just amazing. So all Orwell was doing is just documenting what he was seeing. And it was classified as some kind of a futuristic dystopian fantasy. But Orwell knew the Jew. See?
Nazis were enemies of communism. Communism killed hundreds of millions. Hitler allegedly killed 6 million Jews. It's untrue. It's just not true. It's a fabrication. That so-called Holocaust is quite simply a fabrication. You can spend a couple of hours on the internet, and if you seek out the revisionists, the best revisionists, you'll see all the evidence points one way and all of the emotion points in the other way. The emotion fully backs 6 million Jews wickedly killed in gas chambers by the Nazis. Ooh. All the emotions on one side, all the evidence is on the other. How on earth, in a couple of years, do you cremate 6 million corpses? It's not possible. With the number of gas ovens that they had at the most at Auschwitz or anywhere, the evidence is just absolutely against every time. But minds no longer run on evidence. People's minds today are gone. They watch soap operas and TV. It's all emotion, emotion, emotion. And then the Holocaust is true. Or it seems truth is then defined by emotion. What makes me feel chocolate is true. What makes me feel uncomfortable because it goes against what I think is not necessarily true or untrue. What does truth depend on? It depends on the evidence. Who still today has minds that run on evidence? Not many. People's minds, people don't think. They don't want to think. And quite honestly, they're incapable of thinking. And guess what? Their education today is made so that they won't think. In the old days, you used to learn logic, and you used to learn arguments, and you used to so on. Today, no longer. No, 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 no. You're taught to run on emotion. People run on emotion, and then they cannot understand how the Holocaust is not true, because they're judging by emotion. But if you want to know whether the Holocaust is true or not, go by the evidence. Look up the evidence, and you'll see, if you've got a half a brain in your head, you'll see in a short space of time that the Holocaust is quite simply a fabrication. 6 million gassed. There wasn't one deadly gas chamber, there wasn't one gas chamber in Nazi Germany which was killing human beings. Not one. What there was in the concentration camps were disinfection chambers where Cyclone B gas was used to de-louse clothing of prisoners as they came into the camps. That there was. That there is the evidence for. the evidence of the prussic acid is a blue stain in the concrete of these disinfection chambers that you find. That is evidence. In the walls, it's evidence. But in the walls of the alleged gas chambers, often built after the war, it's a fabrication, sheer fabrication. But that's the stupidity of modern man. Modern man thinks he's so smart. He's got so many universities. Everybody now goes to university, and everybody becomes stupid at these modern universities. Who can deny it? I said yesterday, I think, that you come out of these modern universities with a degree in a circular shape, colored black, with two ears on top. They're Mickey Mouse degrees in these modern universities. They're not universities at all. They're the appearance of universities without the substance or reality. The whole of the modern world is appearances. Appearances inherited from yesterday of a world that's disappearing and gone. It's been emptied out by those who have been clever enough to fool the masses. And we know who those who are clever enough to fool the masses. And the masses want to be fooled.
Herman Rosenblatt received international attention for his story about being a hungry little boy in a Nazi concentration camp who was thrown apples every day by a little girl on the other side of the fence. Years later, according to the story, Rosenblatt met that same girl on a blind date in New York City, and he proposed on the spot.
I used to come by every day, bring the apple, have in my jacket and a piece of bread, and he used to say, I'll see you tomorrow.
The story landed Herman and Roma Rosenblatt on Oprah twice and in newspapers all over the world. They also got a book and movie deal. But the story wasn't true.
Why did you do it? Why did you tell such a big lie to so many people for so long?
It wasn't a lie. It was my imagination. And in my imagination, in my mind, I believed it. Even now I believe it, that she was there and she threw the apple to me.
How can you say it wasn't a lie? It wasn't true, and you know it's not true.
Yes, it's not true. But in my imagination, it was true.
Rosenblatt says he made the story up to give people hope and to promote understanding about the Holocaust. But members of his own family say his real motivation was money.
So you were not motivated in any way by money?
No.
This is from your son. He said that he knew you were lying for years and he couldn't get you to stop. And here's his quote. It was always hurtful. My father is a man who I don't know. How do you respond to that?
I don't know. I can't respond to it. I don't know why he said it. I don't know what. Maybe I'll ask him.
Herman and Roma Rosenblatt told their false story publicly for more than a decade, but it all fell apart about 6 weeks ago after Holocaust scholars proved that it was physically impossible for prisoners to approach the fence at the concentration camp where Herman was kept, and that Roma's family was actually more than 200 miles away at the time.
Why did your wife agree to go along with this? Did she ever express any reservations?
Because she loves me.
Why is she not here today?
Because I don't want her to be here today. It's too much going on.
Was it difficult for your wife to have to go out very publicly and tell a story that she knew wasn't true?
It was. But she loves me so much that if she thinks that's good for me, she'll go along with it.
Rosenblatt is remarkably unrepentant about his years of lying.
I pronounce my love for you forever.
When you look at that, does it make you uncomfortable at all?
No.
You think that was the right thing to do?
Yeah.
And while you were up on the stage there in front of all those people, yeah, in the back of your mind, were you not thinking,
no,
I'm not telling the truth here?
No.
Let me ask you just quickly about
it. I didn't hear you say you agreed to that. Do we agree to that?
Our interview was frequently interrupted by this man, Harris Solomon, who says he is planning to produce a fictionalized movie account of Rosenblatt's story, despite complaints from critics. Rosenblatt says he wants people to know that he did what he did with good intentions.
So if you had to do it over again, would you tell the same story?
Yeah.
You would?
Yes.
And something I wanted to point out to you, you know, there are many pictures about the Russian liberating Auschwitz, and there's never any snow. And the snow was honestly that high. And so I have some connection with the Russian embassy, and I was there once, and I said, something puzzles me. Those photos are fakes because there's no snow. And they said, well, yes, they are not fakes, but when the army came, they didn't have cameras, they didn't photograph. So only much later, when they realized we should have pictures of it, they took pictures like you see now. But this is definitely not in Auschwitz and not the liberation of Auschwitz. There were not that many people with clothes and children and no snow.
And so I remember when I used to tell the Jews that 6 million of them didn't actually die in the Holocaust, I was expecting them to rejoice with the good news. But instead they got really mad and they said, no, no, they were tortured and burned. I'm like, no, it's actually mathematically not even close to possible. And there's no evidence that it happened at all. They're like, you should be in jail. And I'm like, I'm telling you the good news. The good news, my Jews, is the Holocaust is a wildly exaggerated event to the point of hilariousness. They're like, no, give me my trauma. Give me my pain, because if not, I'm just evil. Every victim is an abuser, and every abuser is a victim. The victim cycle is a circle. It's not a straight line. So if they want to abuse the population, which a lot of them do, that's their job, selling drugs, lies, porn, debt, they have to be the victim or else they can't be the abuser. You understand? Every victim is an abuser. Every abuser is a victim. So when you say, oh, it turns out 6 million of you guys didn't actually die, 6 million Jews didn't even live in Europe at the time. I mean, the facts are right in plain sight. It's so easy to prove. They're like, no, because if not, they're just drug dealers. If they're not victims struggling to hold on to their identity in a world of hateful goyim that want to burn them alive, they're simply bad people.
I grew up in the 50s, and we Jewish kids had no idea that a Holocaust ever existed. Perhaps we were the first Holocaust deniers. If not, Jewish historian Jacob Marcus certainly was. For in the 1950 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Marcus wrote that it was thousands of Jews, not 6 million, that perished during World War II. Not a single gas chamber was mentioned. It wasn't until the 60s, when pro-Israel lobbies grew in power, that the number 6 million and gas chambers suddenly was served up to a gullible public. Working with Jewish Hollywood, the lobbies needed to manipulate political opinion to support Israel. By playing victim, they could extort millions and eventually billions of dollars for their Zionist agenda. The book and movie Diary of Anne Frank, exposed as a fabrication, helped further their agenda. I guess all that smoke was inspired by Elie Wiesel's Night, where he wrote that Jews were thrown live into flaming ditches at Auschwitz. No way. Auschwitz-Birkenau was built on a swamp with a high water table. Last time I checked, water's not very flammable. That mass grave they're digging would have been filled with water by now. And why are there so many Holocaust survivors? If those evil Germans were so determined to kill off the Jews, then how did Elie Wiesel and even Otto Frank, father of Anne Frank, survive to tell their tales? Is it because efficient Germans didn't put prisoners to death, but to work? Historian Jacob Marcus did cite work camps, not death camps, as places of incarceration. And according to forensic evidence expert Fred Leuchter, not a single homicidal gas chamber ever existed.
I personally made photographs and produced a great deal of photographic evidence of the hardware and facilities that we found in Poland. The forensic samples that I removed from the facilities, the control sample from delousing facility number one of Birkenau, and all of the other samples from the alleged gas execution rooms were properly taken, packaged, and packaged for submission to the laboratories. I examined the facilities, And I made a determination that they were incapable of supporting the use of hydrogen cyanide gas for purposes of execution or otherwise. But additionally, it would be necessary to remove samples, return them to the United States for testing at an independent laboratory to in fact confirm what my visual inspection indicated, that these facilities never in fact contained hydrogen cyanide gas.
That's the gas emitted from Zyklon B, used for disinfection and delousing prior to and during World War II. And that's the only evidence of mass executions we get. Cans of Zyklon B, piles of shoes, and photos of dead inmates, many who died of typhus even after the liberation. And where's the evidence of any gas chambers? All we get are reconstructed ones.
The first night that you were brought here, everybody was taken, stripped.
Those are survived.
Stop there. He's got to keep his book Night a bestseller since he wrote that Germans threw babies into flaming ditches, which was impossible given the high water table.
It shrank. The country became the town the ghetto the street room, the room the cattle car. Mm. And then a gas chamber.
But why didn't Weasel mention a gas chamber when he first wrote Night just 13 years after the war ended? Because there was none, that's why. If Weasel and all the Jews are so sure the Holocaust happened, why are they so afraid of those who challenge their narrative? It's because their narrative, though full of holes, is their bread and butter. If we all want to survive the Holocaust, then maybe we should do what Weasel has done. He's made a fortune from it.
Welcome to the
עובדות חשובות שמעבירות דברים שלא קיבלנו בבית הספר, לא קיבלנו בתוכנית הלימודים, כשם שלא לימדו אותנו גם בחינוך גבוה. נתתי הרצאות לפני מורות ומורים להיסטוריה. למה באמת היטלר היה נגד היהודים? מה הוא רצה מהם? מה הפריעו לו? אבל הדברים כתובים כאן במיין קאמפף. זה הספר יצא רק לאחרונה, התירו לתרגם ממקם בעברית, זה אסור כל השנים. אבל יש לי תרגום קודם יותר שיד ושם תרגם קטעים, להם היה מותר. היטלר טוען בספר שלו שהיהודים הם קומוניסטים. הם עשו את המהפכה ברוסיה, הם הרגו שם 30 מיליון רוסים. את כל האינטליגנציה, בצורה אכזרית ונוראה. ואת זה הם רוצים לעשות לכל העולם. הארץ הבאה בתור זה גרמניה. הם הקימו את המפלגה הקומוניסטית והסוציאליסטית הגרמנית, וזה נכון. אם אנחנו לא נתגבר אליהם עכשיו, הם יחסלו אותנו, וישחטו גם כאן 20 מיליון איש את כל האינטליגנציה. וכך הם הלכו מארץ לארץ. כשבסופו של דבר האינטליגנטים היחידים, החכמים היחידים, יהיו רק היהודים. זה, והוא חוזר על זה הרבה פעמים, שלא תהיה טעות. והוא צודק. את המהפכה ברוסיה עשו היהודים. את הצבא הרוסי בנה טרוצקי. הוא הקים את היבססקי הבריאה, המחלגה היהודית של המפלגה הקומוניסטית. שחבריה הלשינו את האבא ואת האמא, את האח ואת הבן. מי שיש לו סידור או אפילו ספר ללימוד עברית, אני כבר לא מדבר על תפילין ומקווה. את הכל הוא הרס, גם אצל היהודים. אבל ודאי אצל הרוסים. בתמונה של פוליטביורו הראשון, זה כמו הממשלה ברוסיה, מתוך 13 חברים, 6 יהודים. מי הקים את הקגבה? לפני כן קראו לו אין כבודה. יהודים? אם כן, הדברים טובים מפורש. הוא לא שנא את היהודים בגלל שיש להם פאות.
הוא לא שנא אותם בגלל שהם שומרים מצוות, בגלל שהם קומוניסטים. והוא כותב כאן בצורה ברורה, היהודים הרסו את הדת ואת האמונה, הם הפיצו בגרמניה את הכפירה באלוקים. את זה הוא כותב כאן, אתם מבינים עכשיו למה הם לומדים את זה בית ספר? כי מי כותב את תוכניות הלימודים? אותם שמאלנים. הם ודאי לא יכתבו שהיטלר רצה להרוג את היהודים בגלל שהם אבות השמאל העולמי ואבות המרקסיזם, קומוניזם, לניניזם. אבל את זה הוא כותב. הרסו את כל הערכים. הרעילו את כל הספרות והתיאטרון. מי זה אותם? יהודים שומרי תורה ומצוות, התיאטרון הגרמני? מתוך 9 עיתונים גדולים בגרמניה, 7 היו של יהודים.
Who knows the first two laws that Hitler implemented? Hitler, יימח שמו וזכרו, first two laws that Hitler implemented that not only put him in a different status than everybody else for the rest of history, but also made what's called until this day the biggest financial miracle in history. Who knows the first two laws? Before the Nuremberg laws. Before that, we're talking about years before it. Hitler first comes into power. What's the first two laws? Okay, I'll save you the time. Rule number one, no more pornography. No more homosexuality, none of that garbage. Not allowed. Berlin, in the 30s, in the 20s, was the Sodom and Gomorrah of the day. They were the Las Vegas of the day. They were the Sodom and Gomorrah of the day. Homosexuality, pornography, all the bestiality, all the garbage of the world, that was the capital of the world. He outlawed it, you're no longer allowed, closed all the bars, all the gay clubs, all the production, which were all run by Jewish people, unfortunately. Second rule. What's the second rule? Second rule was, you're not allowed to charge interest. No more interest. Now you would think, why? What does he care about interest? Well, because all the people that had the money, that lent the money out, were Jews. He didn't like it. So he said, no more interest. Why? Because of the high interest that the Jews charged people was so high, it ruined, it destroyed the economy in Germany. They destroyed, just like they destroyed Russia a few years before that through their communism over there. Jews destroyed Russia, not Goyim. Jews destroyed. Communism is by Jews. Well, don't let anybody confuse you. You look at history, Karl Marx, all the other Reshaim, they're all Jews. Wicked, but nonetheless Jews. They destroyed Russia, and he wrote in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf, they destroyed Russia, now they're destroying Germany, that's why I have to destroy them. Now, this doesn't make he's right. The point is, that's actually real true history. Now, he saw that the Jews are controlling the financial system and they're charging such high interest, they destroyed the German economy. To the extent that by the time you arrived to go to the store to buy bread, you had to take a whole horse carriage full of money. By the time you arrived at the store, it wasn't enough. Why? Because the inflation rate was so high. The bread became so much more valuable and your money went down. So now he says, what's this, the cause of this? Because nobody could afford to do anything because the interest rates are so high. So he decided no more interest rates. You're not allowed to charge interest rates. And at that time, the Great Depression was happening around the entire world. Everyone was in a financial collapse. America was a financial collapse. England was a financial collapse. Everybody else was collapsing. Germany collapsed worse than everybody else. But after he passed this law of no more interest, within 6 years, Germany became the leading wealthiest economy in the world. They called it a financial miracle. Why? They were the only ones that were bold enough to stop interest. This is one of the biggest reasons of why he hated Jews. Because they destroyed the economy because of their greed. This is happening again.
The book I wrote in about 1975 was, as Rick mentioned, the history of the Hungarian uprising of 1956 against the communist occupation of Hungary, for which I had access to a certain number of CIA files, which were very interesting because the CIA carried out in-depth psychological interrogations of a large number of the Hungarian refugees who came to this country after 1956. And there was no doubt in my mind a very interesting discovery indeed, which I wasn't aware of until I began investigating that. I didn't realize this. The reason I began writing a book about the Hungarian uprising was entirely irrelevant. I decided to write a book about something other than Hitler and the Third Reich, just to show that I wasn't in a rut. But the odd thing was that when I began writing that book, I discovered from the CIA files that the Hungarian people, when they started that uprising, it began as an anti-Jewish pogrom. It was essentially an anti-Jewish revolution and not an anti-communist revolution to begin with for the first few days. The Hungarian people regarded that their government in the 1950s as being a Jewish government. And they regarded the secret police, the dreaded Államvédelmi Hatóság, the AVH, as being a Jewish secret police. And it, essentially it was, because when the Red Army entered Hungary in 1945, they brought back into Hungary all the Jews who had taken refuge in the Soviet Union. And they were the ones who got the plum jobs, and they were the ones who got the trustworthy jobs as secret police chiefs and as torturers. And that's why the Jews were so hated in Hungary by 1956, because they were regarded as the people who had inflicted this nameless misery on the Hungarian people. And so the uprising began as an anti-Jewish uprising. Every one of the Hungarian leaders at that time in 1956, Rákosi and Farkas and Győr and the rest of the Hungarian leaders, they were all Jews. And I never realized that when I set out to write it. It's an extraordinary fact, the way these things are kept away from the public consciousness. And, of course, inevitably, when the book came out, I was accused of anti-Semitism for having written it. But what am I supposed to do when you discover something as a historian? Are you supposed to try and pretend it isn't that? And if you do pretend it isn't that, you're doing the Jewish people more harm than good, I think. I delivered a lecture in Shreveport, in Louisiana, about 6 months ago. And on this occasion, the audience was about as large as this, but half the audience had been taken over by the local Jewish community, and they decided to wreck my meeting by barracking and by interrupting and by being thoroughly obnoxious. And after an hour of this, with the rest of the audience getting very restless at the way they were not being permitted to hear me deliver my lecture, I then said to the leader of the Jewish community who was attacking me, I said, it just came to me like this. I said, I look at myself in the mirror in the mornings and I know that I'm disliked. I've been called disliked by reviewers in England. The Sunday Times called me the most disliked historian in Britain, which caused me to write a letter to the Sunday Times saying, is it the historian's duty to be liked, therefore? And how do you know that I'm the most disliked historian in Britain? Do you stand in Oxford Street with a clipboard asking people, what do you think about historians? How do you rate David? And, oh, he's most disliked. I know, I said to this Jewish mob in my audience, that I am disliked, and I know why I'm disliked. Now, you people have been disliked for 3,000 years. Do you ever look in the mirror and ask yourselves why you are disliked? That might be very... No, I didn't mean it in a... I didn't mean it in a, in an offensive way. I meant it as a helpful, self-analytical way, the way that the communists, the Marxists, to self-criticize and self-analyze. Have you ever analyzed yourselves as a race and said to yourselves, we have been hounded and persecuted and harried and massacred for 3,000 years, why us? And they never ask themselves that question, do they? They never ask them this. They come along and they harry and persecute others and they behave in a thoroughly obnoxious way, as I probably behave in their eyes. But they never ask themselves why, and they never cure their own faults. One of the leader of this faction in the audience stood up furiously. From his accent I could tell not only that he came from England, but from London. And from his accent, in fact, I could tell from which corner of London he came from, because England... Our accents are like that. We're very class conscious in England. We can tell what class somebody is by their accent, and we can tell which street almost they come from. If you've seen My Fair Lady, you'll know this. And I said, you come from Colindale, don't you? And he said, how do you know that? I said, your accent gives you away. And he was the leader of the gang. And he said, are you accusing us? Are you saying that we are responsible for Auschwitz ourselves? And it's a bit of a dazzling question, and when you think about it, I said, well, the short answer is yes. But that's a cruel answer, because to do the question justice, you've got to have a lot of intervening stages, of course. But the short answer, if you want to hop from A to Z, is yes. If you hadn't behaved the way you have as a race for 3,000 years, first the Russians, then the Poles, then the Galicians, then the Austrians, and the rest wouldn't have harried and hounded you from pillar to post, so you end up finding yourselves in Auschwitz. And you've never asked yourselves why. And they still don't want to accept that. To him, that question and my answer was unacceptable. In Germany, it would no doubt have been grounds for another $22,000 fine. In Canada, I would have probably found myself in handcuffs again. But I don't think it was an anti-Semitic answer. It was an attempt to be helpful in a kind of psychiatrist couch way. Analyze yourself. Cast out the mote from thine own eye.
And that's why we've got COVID. Because COVID is a classic case of appearances without the reality. The propaganda is relentless day after day after day. And it's lying all the time about how many that are in the hospitals, what they're in the hospitals for, what does them good in the hospitals, and so on and so on and so on. They're putting the hospitals on ventilators and they're killed. They're put onto ivermectin, and within a few hours they start feeling better. But they are told the exact opposite. Ivermectin is banned, and ventilators are become obligatory for people shoved into the hospitals because of allegedly COVID. It's absolutely wicked what is going on. And the people are too stupid to realize.
Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov. Mr. Bezmianov was born in 1939 in a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. Well, you spoke several times before about ideological subversion. That is a phrase that I'm afraid some Americans don't fully understand. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's over-fulfilled, because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it. Until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom, when a military boot crashes his balls, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. The next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, what matters is essentials. Economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of these former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, he was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades. It's the same pattern everywhere. The time bomb is ticking. With every second, the disaster is coming closer and closer. The time bomb is ticking. With every second, the disaster is coming closer and closer.
The Jew power structure has induced mental illness on a worldwide scale. In essence, Jew mental illness has inflicted worldwide mental illness. That's it. Nothing less.
About what you say. So you scream, "Oh, please look at me, living through an iPhone, TikTok dream. Rate me, date me, grade me, pay me, begging for attention. Boo-hoo, you gone out of your damn mind, kid. Nobody cares about what you do. Wanna play the victim, wanna be the hero, looking like a miserable, confused weirdo. Think you got it figured out for everybody else when you don't even know yourself. All your selfies ain't no revolution, they're slowing down our evolution. I suppose I need to apologize, and if I don't, you're hoping wish I'd die. Oh, cool, another rule, talk about it on their new blog. You've gone out of your damn mind, kid. Nobody cares about what you want. So you cry, not true, I'll fact check you. Getting your opinion approved by some desperate, faceless, nameless, brainless intern writer for the fake news. Hey, you're out of your damn mind. Nobody cares about what they say. Think you got a choice? Think it's something special in the corporate white noise? Tweet this, post that, gram this, talk that, swipe left, tap here to this, not that. You think that they're on your side? They only share what they decide. You're just part of the corruption that's peddling crap for mass consumption. Oh, geez, you labeled me. Your tolerance is so extreme. Which one do I get to be? A fascist, bigot, or a Nazi? You're out of your damn mind, kid. I don't care about what you think. Oh my heavy times. Everybody's angry, living lies. If you broke, joke, woke, broke, think you're gonna save the day. You've gone out of your damn mind, kids. Nobody cares about what you say. You've gone out of your damn mind, kid. Nobody cares about what you say. Cares about what you say.
Let me put it very clearly. You have no constitutional right to endanger the public and spread a disease, even if you disagree. You have no right not to be vaccinated. You have no right not to wear a mask. You have no right to open up your business.
Wait, can I stop you? No right not to be vaccinated? Meaning if they decide you have to be vaccinated, we have to be vaccinated?
Absolutely. And if you refuse to be vaccinated, the state has the power to literally take you to a doctor's office and plunge a needle into your arm. If the vaccination,
where is that in the Constitution?
If the vaccination is designed to prevent the spreading disease. If the vaccination is only to prevent a disease that you will get, for example, if there's a disease that will kill you, you have the right to refuse that, but you have no right to refuse to be vaccinated against a contagious disease.
But you've opened up a whole new area here. So
right.
The government has the right to force someone to be vaccinated. But how do we know what they're providing us from a medical standpoint is accurate? There are doctors who argue that Anthony Fauci is totally wrong in his assessment. And it certainly seems like week to week, month to month, they don't seem to know anything about this virus.
If the majority of the people agree and support that for public health measures, you have to be vaccinated. You have to be vaccinated. They should give you an alternative. The alternative is to live in your home. Don't get vaccinated, but never, ever leave your home or live in a bubble. But if you want to interact with other people, you cannot become Typhoid Mary. The Constitution doesn't give you the right to spread your illness to other people. And you can disagree, you can be a dissenter, you can leave the country, you can go into a bubble. But what you can't do is say, I don't agree with Fauci, therefore I'm going to take the law into my own hands and decide to spread the disease. That's not a constitutional right.
Sorry.
We're mixing the fields of medicine and law, and the proof of something in law seems vastly different than the proof of something in medicine. A lot of the people who are advising us as to the future of vaccinations in this country are the very same people who have been kicked out of major countries for serious failures and injuries resulting from vaccines that they felt were going to be beneficial. I'm very troubled by the legality of what you're suggesting, because it seems like we're very close to a government mandate that we must all be vaccinated. Let me take you in another direction.
I would like to see a government mandate. I hope it's mandated, and I will defend it and will argue that in the Supreme Court of the United States against your views.
With all the data that has emerged, we clearly see just how safe and effective the vaccines are across populations,
including the elderly, those with underlying health conditions, and pregnant and nursing women.
Due to so many people being vaccinated, the number of hospitalizations and deaths decreased greatly since the vaccines were released.
But the numbers of COVID-19 cases are spiking again.
In June, 100% of people who, Rahman al-Islam, died from COVID-19 in Maryland were unvaccinated.
100%.
Unvaccinated people died.
Died.
There is unfortunately a lot of misinformation circulating.
It's important to know the truth.
After over a year of research, clinical trials, and the actual vaccines in use,
we see no evidence of any kind of negative outcome for fertility and no evidence of increased risk to women of childbearing years.
COVID-19 does not discriminate by age or health status.
There is no predicting how severe a case someone will experience.
Unvaccinated people who were hospitalized or died didn't think it would happen to them.
Go take the vaccine.
Get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated.
Get vaccinated. Now.
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 Be smart. Be responsible. Get vaccinated.
If you don't get vaccinated, you're antisocial. This is what the Dutch Prime Minister and Health Minister told us. You don't get vaccinated just for yourself, but also for others. You do it for all of society. That's what I said. Today, this turned out to be complete nonsense. In a COVID hearing in the European Parliament, one of the Pfizer directors just admitted to me, at the time of introduction, the vaccine had never been tested on stopping the transmission of the virus. This removes the entire legal basis for the COVID passport, the COVID passport that led to massive institutional discrimination as people lost access to essential parts of society. I find this to be shocking, even criminal. Please watch the video until the end.
Voor u, mevrouw Small, heb ik de volgende vraag waar ik een duidelijk antwoord op wil. And I will speak in English so there are no misunderstandings. Was the Pfizer COVID vaccine tested on stopping the transmission of the virus before it entered the market? If not, please say it clearly. If yes, are you willing to share the data with this committee? And I really want a straight answer, yes or no, and I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
Regarding the question around, did we know about stopping immunisation before it entered the market? No. We had to really move at the speed of science to really understand what is taking place in the market.
This is scandalous. Millions of people worldwide felt forced to get vaccinated because of the myth that you do it for others. Now, this turned out to be a cheap lie. This should be exposed. Please share this video.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Uphues, coming at you from Right Docs of History. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Kat Lindley from the World Council for Health. It's time to stop the shot.
I'm Dr. Apter.
Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Mary Talley Bowden. We must stop these shots now.
Hello, I'm Dr. Paul Alexander, and I'm working with Dr. Ben Marvel and Stop the Shots.
I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Stop the shot.
I'm Dr. Avani Gupta. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Bruce Burrows, board-certified internist and cardiovascular specialist for 41 years. Stop the shots now. The only thing they're good for is Big Pharma's pocketbook. They're dangerous.
But the lie is not any lie. It is one of the most terrible in history. I mean, people, young people are dying at rates we've never seen before. You know, all of these like mentions of people swimming in the last week, like in Italy and the UK, and suddenly they're dead in the water. I mean, those are the vaccines. You don't have 11 deaths on Italian beaches in one day. In the UK, kids are going swimming, they're dead in the water. I mean, there are massive deaths occurring. The life insurance data is screaming. I mean, this is a humanitarian catastrophe, yet the train rolls on. Mandates continue. Get your jab, get your booster, get the new Novavax, get the new hybrid. You know, it's, we gotta just keep fighting.
They're all unsafe and defective is my new slogan. Unsafe and defective, they're clearly poisonous, and we need to stop the shots.
They must stop the shots. Please listen to me. These doctors care about you. They're smart. They've been watching all the data. They know that these vaccines are toxic and dangerous. Please listen to them. They care about you. The administrators, the bureaucrats, they don't give a shit about you. They're just pushing an agenda.
I'm Dr. Grams. I'm a family physician. And I say stop the shots. These shots are unsafe and effective. They aren't even vaccines. They're an experimental gene therapy based on CRISPR gene editing techniques with no long-term safety studies of the kind that should have been done before this was ever offered to the general public.
I'm Dr. James A. Thorpe, board-certified OBGYN, board-certified maternal fetal medicine. Stop the shots. Stop the C-19 poison injections. We're calling for a worldwide ban. Stop the shots. Thank you.
We must stop the shots as soon as possible. They're killing people all over the world. Simple truth is, they're poison.
I'm Dr. Linnell Lowry. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Finn, infectious disease and toxicology. What will it take to stop the shots?
I'm Dr. Robert Lowry. Stop the shots.
Many physicians are fighting this, and we need your help. In the meantime, we need to stop these shots.
I'm Dr. Steve LaTulipa. For the love of humanity, for the safety of humanity, stop the shots.
Hi, I'm Dr. Molly Rutherford. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Calvin White. Stop the shot.
I'm Dr. Aaron Greer. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Brian Tyson, and I'm telling you to stop the shot.
I'm Dr. Molly James. We need to stop the shots. I can't believe this charade continues. We know they're not safe, they don't work, and they're hurting people. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Terry Lincoln. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Angie Farella. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Aaron Williams. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Deborah Viglione. Stop the shots.
Dr. Avery Brinkley. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Newman. The VAERS data speaks for itself. Please stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Sigla. Stop the shots.
The vaccine has already created so many injuries and too much suffering. So it's about time that we really fight against it. Stop the shot!
Hello, this is Dr. John Winter, MD from Mississippi. It is time to stop these poison shots, period.
I'm Dr. Sonia Narishkin. Please don't let the lives of you or your loved ones be destroyed by the sudden unnecessary deaths of your newborn baby, of your healthy, happy, athletic teen, of you or your spouse in the prime of your life, of your dear aging parent. Don't put yourselves at unnecessary risk for severe, lifelong neurologic damage, autoimmune disease, infertility, or even cancer. Stop the experimental messenger RNA COVID gene therapy shots. Please do your part to stop the shots.
My name is Dr. David Vella, MD. You do not need to live in fear. You do not need to take an experimental gene treatment. Please stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Brian Artis. Stop the shots.
I'm Dr. Judy Mikovits. Please stop the shots. All the shots.
we're going to perform a little magic. You like magic, don't you? We're going to take your boys and turn them into girls. Then we're going to take your girls and turn them into boys. Isn't that an amazing magic trick? We can perform miracles. It's a miracle. Because we're the chosen people. And we can be your God. Yep. We can and we will do all of that and more. You better believe it. Who knows what the future will bring? We're the chosen, aren't we not? And we have a very bright future ahead for you. You will have nothing and be happy. Very, very happy. Well, it's a good thing we got the Frankfurt School over here. Yeah, they're gonna take your country and rip it apart. And you helped us do it! We couldn't have done it without you! How long do you think it took? How long do you think all that took? A very short, about 130 years. That's all it took. From Ellis Island to the phony Joe Biden. 130 years. All those stinking, mentally ill, depraved Jews from Poland and Russia and Ukraine, and they run the world now. They run the world now. What were you doing?